Okay, let's get started again. We have two exciting talks left to do. The first one is by Dave Stevenson, and the title is right up there.
So my talk has to do with a very, very small fraction of the known planets, the planets that happen to be in our solar system. So it's natural to begin by asking, why should you care? It's only a tiny fraction. And the obvious answer is that we have a far greater prospect of understanding them in detail because we do have better data, including in situ data from spacecraft, better gravity determination, magnetic field, heat flow, composition, including noble gases and isotopes. Still, you might wonder whether that better understanding yields a large payoff, and I would argue it does, because much of this better understanding informs us about general processes, not just the specific things that happen for the planets in our solar system, but more generally. And indeed, you can use your more precise understanding of planets in our solar system to test things that you want to use for exoplanets, for example, the equation of state. But I also want to put across to you a philosophical point that I believe strongly, and that is that our planets teach us humility. For indeed, it is the case that planets are complicated. And I would urge you to keep that in mind when thinking about exoplanets, because they're not, in my opinion, going to fit the paradigm that is so popular in astronomy and astrophysics, where you collapse everything into a low-dimension representation of reality, as in the case of the HR diagram. It's not going to work. Planets are more complicated, fundamentally more complicated than stars. And it's because of the nature of the materials that they're made of and the greater variety of histories that they can undergo relative to stars. And I say this from experience because I am a theoretical physicist, I've worked on stars, and I've worked on planets, and it's on that basis that I reach this viewpoint. I'll begin by reminding you about the conditions that are of interest to us if you want to understand a planet such as Jupiter or Saturn, Uranus or Neptune. We are at conditions where the pressures are of order megabars, where megabar is 10 to the 12 in CGS units, 10 to the 11 in SI units. And under those conditions, the energy of compression, pressure times the volume of an ion, is an electronic energy. And that's why the materials behave differently inside planets than the same material when you look at it at one bar. That's why hydrogen can behave as a metal under the conditions of these planets, whereas under normal everyday experience, it has a very different character to it. So we're in this pressure regime where materials will behave very differently from your usual expectations. It's a little bit more difficult to say in a general way what kinds of temperatures you encounter, but when one does modeling of the various bodies of interest, these bodies in particular, then temperatures are typically thousands to tens of thousands of degrees Kelvin based on adiabatic compression from a realistic starting point or the energies of accretion and the rate at which you can lose the energy. These are temperatures for which the material is degenerate, but temperatures for which the material is often a liquid, and of course, the reason why both of those statements can be true is because the energies that determine whether you are in a liquid or solid are much smaller than the energies that determine what the electrons want to do. We also have to keep in mind the menu that we are using when we construct a description of the materials. And the menu is, of course, given to us by the Big Bang and by thermonuclear synthesis in massive stars, leading to this well-known distribution of elemental abundances. And from that, with a little bit of physical chemistry, there arises this usual characterization, which is a statement about low pressures and is useful for thinking about how you put the stuff together, but it's not useful for thinking about how the materials behave once it's inside the planet. So we have, for example, what is usually called gas, hydrogen, and helium, even though we should all keep in mind that it doesn't behave like a gas when it's deep inside Jupiter. Likewise, the things that are labeled ice, because they usually combine with hydrogen, may behave like ices when they're first put into the planet, but need not behave in any sense at all like an ice when it's inside the body. And rock, which is these elements combined typically with oxygen that make up the terrestrial planets. But again, this material in combination with those will potentially have unusual behavior at the high pressures and temperatures that are of relevance for planets. It is nonetheless useful to have this characterization because it informs us about the ingredients that you put into the planet in the first place and about their relative abundances. It tells you immediately, for example, that it might make sense to talk about a sphere that is of cosmic abundance, that is mostly hydrogen, and has a mass like that of Jupiter, but it might not make sense to talk about a cannonball that is pure iron that has the mass of Jupiter. Now, in thinking about what the planets are actually made of, one always begins, of course, with the mass-radius relationships. And this was first done, of course, by Sapolsky and Salpeter. Here is a slightly later version. And you have seen diagrams like this earlier in this meeting, but of course the most important lines here are not the solid lines, which are the cold material behavior, but in the case of something that has hydrogen and helium, the isentropic behavior. For example, this line here, this dashed line, which is a hydrogen-helium mixture and a self-gravitating sphere for various masses. And of course, this flatness here at around about the mass of Jupiter, but actually over a wide range of masses, is characteristic of that material close to an n equals 1 polytrope. And the displacement of Jupiter below that dashed line is already a statement about Jupiter having some heavy elements beyond that of cosmic abundance. And that is a statement that could be made many decades ago, and it's still true. And the fact that Saturn is more displaced tells you that the heavy element abundance in Saturn is much greater than that of Jupiter. This is independent of the question of whether they have a core. For indeed, putting heavy elements into such a body is, to a first approximation, changing the radius by about the same amount, irrespective of whether you put those heavy elements in the core or mix them throughout. In the case of Uranus and Neptune, they don't sit close to any particular single element, but they're closer to ice than anything else. And so one might be tempted to think of these bodies as ice rich. That's not necessarily true, because in the case of these bodies, I can take some of this and some of this and make something that looks like ice. There is actually, from the point of view of mean density, no requirement that Uranus and Neptune have ice. By contrast, hydrogen and helium are so distinctively different from the others that there's no doubt about Jupiter and Saturn. So here are some significant facts about our solar system. Jupiter and Saturn are indeed mostly gas. Jupiter may have a dense core. I'll get back to that. Saturn almost certainly does. They're unquestionably both enriched in heavy elements throughout. And of course, we've known for a long time that Jupiter and Saturn release substantially more energy than they receive from the Sun. And this is a consequence of cooling, primarily over geologic time. That's the standard picture for that. Because the body is cooling, it's also contracting. The energy does not come from contraction. Contraction energy, that is the reduction in gravitational energy is largely balanced by the increase in the internal energy. So from the virial theorem, it's really the change in thermal energy that drives the luminosity. There may also be a contribution from differentiation, and that's especially likely true for Saturn, but in fact there's a lot we don't yet know about Saturn. Uranus and Neptune resist simple characterization. Contrary to what is sometimes claimed, they're not necessarily ice rich. You could build them out of Plutos or Tritons, add a bit of gas on top. Pluto and Triton are not ice-rich bodies, by the way. Pluto and Triton, we know from their mean density, are both mostly rock. And very importantly, and this is something I will come to at the end, these bodies are not layer cakes. In other words, they're not constructed by saying, let's put rock in the middle and then ice on the outside and then gas on top of that. That does not work. Now, there's a lot of interest in the question of cause. That is, a central concentration of material that is more dense than the mean composition of the body. That's the sense in which I'm using the word core here. And the reason why people are interested in this is because it may tell us something about how the planet formed. And it's very important to understand the distinctive difference between two ways of thinking about this. One is to think of a core as being bottom up. This is a popular giant planet picture, the most likely picture in our solar system, but we don't know for sure. A picture in which you build your heavy element embryo and then put gas on top. The top down picture is, we think, from a variety of geochemical evidence, the correct description of terrestrial planets, in which you start out with something that's mixed up during the accretion process and you separate into a core and a mantle. Now, the existence of a core necessarily requires that there's a component that is more dense. But that's not a sufficient condition. The reason why terrestrial planets have a core is not because that core is made of iron, but because it's made of something that is not only more dense, but immiscible. It doesn't mix down to the atomic level. Very important. If iron mixed at the atomic level with the other material in the Earth, you would not have a core. Interestingly, in the case of the giant planets, the presence of this core in large part is thought to be a consequence of the inability to mix back, because as far as we can tell, there is no immiscibility at the abundances in question for rock in hydrogen. You can mix the constituents of rock with hydrogen at the atomic level at the pressures and temperatures of relevance. So if you could go in there with the hand of God and actually mix that stuff up, it would happily be mixed. Now, I want to focus on some problems. I think that is the most useful thing to tell you about, rather than the successes. For indeed, there are major problems with giant planet models. There are, and have been for a long time, equation of state uncertainties. When I say equation of state, I don't just mean pressure as a function of density to particular entropy, but everything you want to get from an equation of state, starting with a Helmholtz or Gibbs free energy and taking derivatives of it to get the various parameters, specific heat, coefficient thermal expansion, Grün-Eisen parameter, as well as pressure as a function of density. And indeed, as I will say a little bit more about in a moment, the theory of the pure N members, including hydrogen, is still not converging. That is to say, we still do not have a complete picture of a kind that you would like to have in order to construct models with complete confidence. It's also true that we have an incomplete understanding of mixtures, and that's very important for your thinking about the planet. And our usual concepts of the relevant materials break down at high pressure and temperature. There's no reason, for example, why hydrogen plus oxygen will necessarily be H2O at very high pressures and temperatures. That's a particular alloy that makes sense at low pressure. It's also true that experiments are difficult. But I want to focus on something that I believe is less well appreciated, which is that historically we have had an unreasonable reliance on Occam's razor, parsimony. Because indeed, the concepts of cause are based on false analogies. For example, the reasoning for why the Earth has a core, which I described a couple of minutes ago, doesn't apply in giant planets, and doesn't, in fact, in all likelihood, apply for bodies that are compositionally like the Earth, but considerably more massive than the Earth. And ideas of planet formation, some of which involve considerable trauma as things crash into each other, do not necessarily lead to a simple separation of materials according to density. We also lack what is perhaps the most valuable technique, certainly historically the most valuable technique for the Earth, which is seismology. With that as an introduction, let me say a little about our picture of what we think is going on in the planet Jupiter, the best understood, perhaps. So here's a pie diagram. Starting from the outside, we believe that this is essentially a fully convective body throughout, and therefore close to a constant entropy throughout. When you get down about 20% in the radius, we expect, on the basis of experimental data and theoretical work, that the molecular hydrogen loses its molecular character, perhaps gradually, and eventually becomes a metal. We think that to a first approximation, this is compositionally uniform, although in a few minutes I'll say more about that. And there's a magnetic field being generated. We have increasing evidence that there is a small rainout of helium, perhaps not very important for the history of the planet, but diagnostic of internal structure and evolution. And then we have the core, and I deliberately put in a dashed line here to remind you that the core should not be thought of as something you could put your hand on. If you went to the boundary between the core and the mantle of the Earth, there probably is a place that, roughly speaking, you could put your hand on with an asbestos glove. But that's probably not true with Jupiter. This is, in all likelihood, messy. So what is the current state of Jupiter modeling? Very briefly, what happened in this field, beginning more than 20 years ago, is that there was an effort that extended over a long period of time that relied heavily on equation of state that did indeed come from Helmholtz free energy, so it was a complete description, especially in the work of Saumon and Chabrier and Hugh van Horn. And this was a chemical approach. Chemical approach means that you identify species and how they interact with each other. This is not first principles quantum mechanics, but it has a lot of merit to it if you understand the interactions. And it was used extensively, particularly in the modeling work of Tristan Guyot. But there was enough uncertainty in this kind of modeling that you could not say for sure whether Jupiter had a core. So the core wandered around from zero to maybe 10 Earth masses, depending on the specific assumptions that you were making. That's not so bad, really, when you think about how big a fraction that is of the mass of Jupiter. It's a fairly small fraction of the mass of Jupiter. The more recent modeling, and all of the work I'm talking about here has the representatives in this room of people who have been doing this. In the case of the more recent modeling, I'm referring, for example, to Nadine Nettleman, who's here. Also, the work that Burkhard Millisser has been involved in. Burkhard's also here. And of course, Chabrier is here, Tristan is here. This is closer to first principles and should be better, but it's difficult to do this more nearly first principles approach based on solving Schrodinger's equation with some approximations. It has difficulties at intermediate densities, like at a pressure of about half a megabar. It's difficult to form a complete description of the Helmholtz free energy over the entire range. Still, there is, in a sense, for a wide pressure range, a convergence of theoretical understanding for hydrogen. Curiously, perhaps, the latest models for Jupiter have an even larger range in estimates of the core mass than existed, for example, when I was a graduate student in the 1970s. So much for progress. All the way from a few to 50 to masses, why? The main reason, not the only reason, but the main reason, and this gets to my parsimony concern, the main reason is different assumptions about how you construct the model. How much complexity do you put into it? Do you try and make the model as simple as possible, meaning core and everything else uniform, which is what Bill Hubbard did with Burkhard Müller? That ran into some difficulty. Or do you put in a compositional boundary somewhere, perhaps related to where helium is separating, as in the work of Nadine Nettleman? So the primary reason is something that's very hard to handle, which is different assumptions about the composition. People often ask about the character of going from molecular to metallic hydrogen. And that's still an issue, but the fact is that at the moment there's no current evidence for a first order transition. And I'm not even sure this is such a big issue, because the current models, even though you might be able to squeak in a first order phase transition, it's going to have a small entropy and density jump. And the compositional effects will be bigger than that. Insolubility of helium is now quite well established. And of course, the big difficulty is that we have to connect this if we want to get some kind of uniqueness. Gravity will never give us uniqueness. But we have to connect this to our ideas about how the planet formed. So here, for example, are the models from Nadine Nettleman. I don't want to spend time on the details of these, but notice that even with Jupiter, there's some complexity in the model, Saturn less well constrained. The equation of state issue is quite a serious one. There are fairly big discrepancies shown here, 10% or more between the various equations of state. Again, don't worry too much about the details here. Just notice the scale here, delta P upon P as percentage for different curves, different equations of state. And this is a problem. We can, of course, hope to get some experimental input. For example, at the National Ignition Facility at Livermore, that may help. There is a problem with high-pressure calibration. Even this wonderful multi-billion-dollar facility can't give you absolute pressures without very precise calibration. The failure of theory at modest pressures needs to be better understood and linked to experiment. I think there is some reason for optimism here, but it is a serious problem. One nice story is the helium rain story, for indeed it does seem that helium raindrops form in Jupiter, that neon partitions into the droplets, argon does not. The most recent theoretical calculations of this were published last week. The PhysRev letters by Hugh Wilson, Burkhard Müller, and this is a nice story, not just because of the consistency with what we see in the observations, but also because in some sense neon in particular is a thermometer. The extent to which neon is depleted, and it is observed to be depleted by nearly a factor of 10 in the atmosphere of Jupiter, is a thermometer. It's telling you about the conditions in which it goes into the helium raindrops and the helium raindrops fall out. For their calculations, about 5,000 Kelvin at the place where it happens. Unfortunately, it's not known precisely what pressure, but it may be a half to one megabar. Associated with this, there may be an electromagnetic skin effect that affects the magnetic field, especially in the case of Saturn. And there's a new paper by Sabine Stanley in GRL this year showing that you can spin axisymmetrize Saturn's magnetic field, as is observed. Saturn's magnetic field has a dipole aligned with the rotation axis. And here's the pattern for the field. The fact that it has so little variation with longitude is an indication of the spin axis symmetrization associated with the flow that is produced in the region where the helium raindrops form. And of course, we have a mission coming up, Juno, that will be launched in 2011 and arrive in 2016. It will tell us how much water is in the deep atmosphere. That's a constraint for the interior models. It will give us exquisitely accurate determination of gravity and magnetic field. And from this, one can get some constraints about the core, but remember, one of my main points of this story I'm giving you is that the core is ill-defined, but certainly with better information in the equation state, knowing the amount of water in the envelope, knowing the gravitational field even better than we do now, perhaps getting the precession constant, measuring the tides from the Galilean satellites, bringing all that information together will tell us something about the core. This is a very exciting mission. I want to move now in the last 5 minutes to Uranus and Neptune, for I believe Uranus and Neptune are telling us an important story. They are an essential part of understanding planetary origin and evolution. They are perhaps naked cores of Jupiter and Saturn, presumably formed in the presence of nebula because they do have some gas. And of course, we know of analogs, what appear to be analogs in other systems. They have a very distinctively different magnetic field, a heat flow that suggests that these bodies are in part stably stratified. I can't resist pointing out a beautiful and prescient paper by Al Cameron, received back in 1974, the first paper that talked about giant impacts. For indeed, he says here, the tilt of the planet can easily occur as a result of a major collision. And the point here is that Uranus and Neptune may tell us something about the way planets formed, at least in our solar system, and that is preserved as a memory of the structure of the planet. We know a fair bit about these planets, but perhaps not as much as we would like. The rotation rates are somewhat uncertain. The densities, of course, are much higher than Saturn, and that tells us about the presence of heavier elements. Now, what's a possible model for Uranus and Neptune? You could have rock, ice, gas. This model does not work. It gives the wrong moment of inertia. It's too small. It also gives the wrong heat flow. It gives too much heat after 4.5 billion years and probably does not give the right magnetic field. You could take that same model and mix everything up. That doesn't work either. There's certainly enough energy from accretion to mix everything up. So this is not a ridiculous model. And thermodynamically, it's likely that these constituents could mix. When I use the word mix, I don't mean particles suspended in a liquid. I mean mixed down to the atomic level, dissolved. This model fails to give the right J2, also fails to give the right heat flow, too much heat after 4.5 billion years, also gives the wrong atmosphere and gives a magnetic field that's not consistent with what is observed. So it seems as though one needs something in between. With a molecular weight gradient, this will give you the right heat flow. It can be adjusted to give you the right J2, no surprise there. A model like this would say that Uranus and Neptune are actually very hot, 10,000 degrees inside. And it gives perhaps a distinctive environment for the dynamo, as in the models of Sabine Stanley and Jeremy Bloxam. And here is a schematic representation of the interiors of Uranus and Neptune. This is from Tristan Guyot. And, of course, the main point of this diagram is that it's a mess. What's a plausible scenario? Well, if you accrete a planet like this, you may set up a molecular weight gradient at time zero. And then, as the outside cools by radiation to space, you develop layers as you get competition between the compositional gradient and the thermal contraction. And this is a well-known phenomenon in fluid dynamics. It's called double diffusive convection. And so one can build up steps. These steps separately convect. This is a speculative story. It has not been worked through in detail. But it is one that has promise. So what are the main conclusions? Our planets can tell us about things that are beyond anything you can hope to learn outside our solar system. It looks now, despite the uncertainties I mentioned, that Jupiter and Saturn do have cores, but the picture is not a simple one. The core is messy, And I say this in large part because of Uranus and Neptune. So here I'm saying, let's use Uranus and Neptune, which are naked in some sense, to say something about what may be happening inside Jupiter and Saturn. And to the extent that this picture makes sense, it points to a role of traumatic events, giant impacts, embryo merging, whatever your favorite fantasy is. Future work, well, you know, the irony here is that the first two items could have been and were said by me and others 20, 30 years ago. We still are not quite there in understanding how hydrogen behaves. Shocking but true, quantum mechanics is hard to do when you don't have a crystal, and it's not a crystal. Better understanding the thermodynamics of mixtures. We are going to learn from Juno. We hope eventually to have a probe into Saturn and perhaps into Uranus and Neptune. And of course, we want to merge this with accretion models. And I put Uranus and Neptune exclamation mark because I think the importance of Uranus and Neptune are perhaps underappreciated. And I'll end with, of course, the reminder that the first planetary system other than our own was discovered by Galileo almost exactly 400 years ago. And this, of course, is what we're trying to do. Thank you.
Questions? So, Burkhard Müllitzer, since this meeting is about exoplanets, why don't you tell us about your favorite theory, why some of them are so inflated?
Yeah. This must be a setup. I didn't. Let me make the obvious point, which is not specific to a single model, which is, of course, and people have said this already, it's not really an answer. But going back to the radius mass diagram, you should never think of these lines as single lines, they're families. And of course, for each entropy, you will have a line. And so whatever story you seek to understand the radius function of mass, you must specify the entropy. And so that requires an energy source to prevent the planet from going down to the entropy that you would normally expect after 4.5 billion years. I don't know to what extent Tristan is going to talk about this later. I have no desire to expound on a particular model I've been involved in.
Dave, you mentioned the lack of constraints from astero-seismological data for giant planets. As you know, there have been some claims of oscillations for Jupiter about 20 years ago. And if I recall correctly, there was some time where at JPL people, including you, I believe, were thinking of doing this kind of observations. Can you tell us more about that?
Sounds like another setup question, because 2 weeks ago at Caltech I ran a workshop on planetary seismology, half of which had to do with seismology and giant planets, and very strong group of French workers in the field, Schmitter, various others, presented their work on using Doppler spectroscopy, an instrument that may fly on the European part of the flagship to the Jupiter system in about a decade, the Laplace part of that. The puzzle with seismology for Jupiter is still the one of sources. Because when you think about the likely sources for exciting free oscillations, they seem to be too small. Now, maybe we are not being inventive enough. And at that meeting, we talked about thunderstorms and various other various exciting ways of doing things as distinct from sort of dull background things like what people normally talk about for the excitation of normal modes in the sun. So there's still a possibility. I agree with you. There's a hint in the data. It's not clear whether they're really getting something that's entirely credible. But this is an exciting possibility. The other kind of seismology that could arise is in dynamic tides. Now, that's not seismology in the normal sense, but the Juno mission is going to measure the tidal response of Jupiter caused by the Galilean satellites. And in the usual way of thinking about this, classic text of Zhakov and Tribitzin, for example, people think about this as a hydrostatic tide. But of course, it's not going to be a hydrostatic tide. Just as the tides raised by the moon on the Earth are not hydrostatic, and the sloshing frequency of the Pacific Ocean is similar to the tidal frequency, and that's why there's an unusually large recession of the moon from the Earth at the current epoch. Should there be a compositional boundary of the kind that Nadine Nettleman has in her models, for example, that can show up as an interfacial mode, just like gravity waves at an interface, in the tidal band. And so it will cause the Lud numbers to be significantly different from the hydrostatic values. So that's not quite seismology, but getting partway there. So there may be things that we don't yet have that could be revolutionary in our understanding of these bodies. There is also, as I'm sure you know, many of you know this, a lot of work on trying to understand the Q, the tidal Q. And it's so theoretical and difficult to put your hand on in terms of observations that I'm not sure that that's going to pay off. But that's another possibility. Well, there are people in this room who have worked on that also.
Yeah. There are people in this room who've worked on planet formation, and it's still unclear whether planets form only by core accretion or by gravitational instability. And one of the reasons people want to try and see if planets, see whether planets have cores or not. You, for example, this ellipsoidal precession idea with this Hadley 13, is to see if there's a core. One of the things I've been meaning to look up or find out about, maybe you can tell me, is how you can tell the difference. If a planet did form just from gas with no core through gravitational collapse, how and then went on to accrete planetesimals, and these settled, how can you tell the difference? You know.
Well, it depends very much when the accretion takes place. If I have a very distended envelope of gas, and I put planetesimals in, they can sink all the way to the center, and that's in the kind of model that Alan Boss has worked on. It actually goes all the way back to stuff that Al Cameron did. Al Cameron did everything in the 70s. But if you put a planetesimal into Jupiter or something that's headed towards the final state of Jupiter, it doesn't go to the center because the temperatures are already high enough that it will dissolve as it goes in. So don't imagine that you can make a core just by dropping planetesimals into a planet. It doesn't work. It only works if you do it very early on, non-degenerate, relatively low temperature, and then also you can have stuff just sinking by condensation, just as you would in the solar nebula. So there are ways of making cores without building the core first. There are a lot of issues there about whether that could really explain what we see in our solar system. Alan Boss is here somewhere, and I'm sure he'd be delighted to talk about it if he were given a chance, but don't give him a chance.
All right, Alan, here's your chance.
Ravit Halnet, who has actually done the models in great detail. So is Ravit in the room by any chance?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, give a microphone to Ravit, please.
Yes, Ravit is...
Basically, I'm going to repeat what Dave has just said. In principle, it is possible to accrete a significant amount of Heisey material in the early stage of the evolution, where the planet is very extended and the densities are low and the temperature is low, and then you can form quite a significant core. The difference may be with the composition of the core, because I found, for example, that icy grains would evaporate, unlike silicates. So maybe then you could see you could say that within the disk instability model, the core is predicted to be depleted with ices compared to the core accretion model. But what I would like to state here is, for the people who don't do theory, is that it's extremely hard to distinguish these things. And the truth is that it's nearly impossible for us as theorists is to really say what the planet looks like inside. And in the concept of exoplanets, you know, when people talked about direct imaging and to looking at the atmosphere and maybe see what the composition of the atmosphere may be, there are so many physical processes, for example, like cloud formation or grain settling, that could give you, you cannot, it's very hard, right? So one observation can have 10,000 explanations, so it's very hard to come up with a clear picture, and that just has to keep, you know, be in mind. That's it.
I think all niches are occupied. That is to say, core accretion may be the best explanation in our solar system, but that doesn't mean it applies everywhere for every case.
So you, Travis Barman here, right here. You have a slide that illustrates the differences between the Simon-Chabrier equation of state and other. Sorry, you had a slide illustrating the magnitude of differences between our understanding of the equation of state for hydrogen and helium.
Yes.
And you compare the Simon-Chabrier equation of state with another one. Could you comment on how significant differences of this order are for our ability to interpret observations, or I mean, how seriously should one take this?
It's quite difficult to answer your question, and the reason is that there are several factors involved here, not just your naive notion of how pressure behaves with density, but also what the isentrope is doing. See, some models produce a very flat isentrope in a given pressure region, meaning the Grunison parameter is low. And there some models, likewise, through the Maxwell relationship, will give you a small coefficient of thermal expansion. So there's not quite enough information here to talk about a trade-off. But part of what seems to happen in the modeling activity is that because some of the discrepancy is actually at low density, people are struggling to get models that work at low density. That should be solvable. But the catch is that you need, to do a proper evolution model, you need a free energy. So you need something that is more than just a table. You need a function that you can do first and second derivatives of, that goes smoothly all the way from the low density behavior to the high density behavior. And that doesn't quite exist at the moment. People agree at very high pressure. There is, I would argue, good reason to think that this is closer to reality than that at this region approaching a megabar. But the whole thing is not yet fitting together. And there are entropy, integral constraints. That is, if you have a reference state at low pressure and temperature, and you know from theory what should happen at very high pressure and temperature, then there's an integral to go from one to the other that will give you the right free energy difference. And I think that has not been fully employed. I have not really answered your question satisfactorily because I don't think it has a simple answer, but I'm giving you some of the factors that go into it. Possibly Burkhardt or Nadine or Jonathan or somebody wants to make more comments, because these are the people who are actually doing the models. You know, I'm in this privileged position of having retired from making detailed models quite a long time ago. that makes it easy for me to criticize.
Okay, I'm afraid you will have to move the rest of this fascinating discussion to the dinner time to give Tristan a chance. Thank you very much. And now on to the exoplanet modeling by Tristan Beer.